Hello and welcome to episode 120 of Unfunny Nerd Tangent and something a little different. What happens when the internet goes out in Arizona? Well, since it might be because of a mysterious alien probe that threatens all communication on the planet, or maybe it's something else entirely, but anyway, we fall back on a plan B and decided to talk about a movie that celebrates its 35th anniversary this year, and that's Star Trek IV: The Voyage Home. And to help me out in a big way and slingshot around the sun with me from the Autopod Decepticast, he just wants to know where the nuclear vessels are. Joining me from his car is Caleb Carter. Caleb, how are you?
I'm good. I'm driving around Missouri. The internet works fine here. And I got my son in the back seat, so happy to jump on, Greg, and happy to talk about Star Trek IV. And whatever else comes our way, yeah.
That's it. Well, we thought, you know, at a pinch, what can we jump on and talk about to get a show out there today? And yeah, well, you know, 1986 was 35 years ago, and that's when this movie came out, which is sort of, I think it's the one Star Trek movie that even non-Star Trek people have seen or at least know about. They're always like, oh, is that the one with the whales? Yeah, I've seen that one.
Yeah, exactly. I saw this one a lot. I didn't see it in the theaters, but I saw it a lot, regular rotation on HBO network television. And like you said, I mean, it's an unusual one. It's an outlier, in fact, in the fact that they literally bring Star Trek to, at that time, present day. So I think it's a real fun one for me.
Yeah, it's a weird one in a way, too, because not only does it have sort of the futuristic Star Trek characters like in, at the time, modern day San Francisco of all places as well. It's one of those movies where I think everyone likes to sort of lean towards Wrath of Khan as like the best Star Trek movie, which I would agree with. But then there's a big difference between like what you necessarily might think like the best movie is as opposed to your favorite. So like I would agree. Yeah. With people that say that Wrath of Khan is the best Star Trek movie, but right. This one's probably my favorite just because it's an easier watch. It's fun. You know, like like you said, it's that one that was on TV all the time. So,
it's Wrath of Khan's classic. It's the ship battle in space. Star Trek IV, I'm really curious, and I don't know anything about, like, you know, did they pitch, you know, like, pitching this, like, we're gonna bring them into the present day. We're going to have an environmental aspect to the movie. And it's going to be slightly comedic, you know, not, shouldn't say slightly, it's going to be very comedic. And it's interesting, we didn't have time to research, normally I would have gone on Wiki or wherever and kind of checked like the development of this, how'd this come to be? And then of course it's amazing that it works as well as it does. If this was to be pitched to me as a fourth movie, I would be apprehensive, but somebody sold the idea and that idea worked really well. I think you've talked to most people that are not Star Trek fans that have ever watched a Star Trek movie. This is probably one of the top ones that they've probably seen.
Yeah. And like I've seen interviews with the filmmakers and stuff in the past where they sort of said, well, like we had the Wrath of Khan and you know, like that's the movie everybody loved. Everyone sort of thought like that put Star Trek back on the right track after the first movie was sort of a bit, you know, like a sort of a 2001 wannabe, almost, you know.
Yeah, that aesthetic, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, but like, so after the Wrath of Khan, we're basically, and then the Search for Spock. Like, even though they're still sort of fun, excitement movies, like there is some heavy stuff in those. Whereas, obviously, like Spock dies, like spoilers, kids, for a movie that's 100 years old. But like, Spock dies at the end of Wrath of Khan, and it's kind of a downer, you know. And then in Search for Spock, like Kirk's son, David, he dies as well.
Yeah.
And then not only that, but like the Enterprise is destroyed. So
yes,
it's kind of, and then even at the end of that movie, like Kirk and Bones and everybody, they're kind of like, they're happy that Spock is back, but what happens to them? Like they just stole the Enterprise and it got destroyed, and Kirk's son is dead, and they're sort of fugitives, and it just kind of ends. So it is kind of, you know, so that they, I think they're looking for something a bit more lighthearted as well, as a way to kind of round it out. So
yeah, I haven't seen the movie in a while. I forget that they're in a Klingon warship the whole time.
Yeah,
That's what they go back in time with, and that's what they crash land on Earth. Well, I should say crash land, but they submerge it. I forgot about that, and that's really interesting. It really is. By this point in the series, it's really turned them into a motley crew, and I really think because of that, they can get away with certain types of behavior.
Even at the start of the movie, when they're about to, because they're on Vulcan at the start and they're about to go, like they think, oh well, we're just going to fly home and kind of face the music. So, but they have spray painted the Bounty on the side of the Klingon warship. So it's like a real kind of, you know, Horatio Hornblower kind of thing. They really have sort of leaned heavily into that, even more so than they did on the TV series. So I always thought that was kind of interesting. So,
Kirk's gotten completely outside the box. He's gone completely rogue. He's not even in the Enterprise anymore, but they're still pulling it off.
Yeah, and he's still Admiral Kirk in this as well. Like it's he's still technically, like, he's doing all this stuff like to try and get back to the captain's chair, and it's funny how like Wrath of Khan and Search for Spock and The Voyage Home kind of became this accidental trilogy, where it's like, you know, obviously like Star Wars is always about the trilogies and stuff, but then like Star Trek has its trilogy as well. It just happens to be movie 2, 3, and 4. which is kind of it's accidental sort of thing that happened, but it works. So
I wonder if it works so well. I wonder if, you know, the time that it came out, I wonder if they could get away with a certain kind of, I don't know, it works in present day. I was about to say, I wonder if it works because it was released in the mid to late 80s, but it still holds up. So I kind of redact what I was getting ready to postulate.
Well, you get that. You do get that fish out of water kind of stuff, I guess. And like you said, the TV show kind of did that a couple of times where they would sort of, they found themselves. I mean, there was one episode and they do literally go back to like the 60s in America. But then there's that other one where they go to the planet where it's like somebody left a book behind or something, and it was all about gangsters and the mob and stuff like that, and the whole planet's like government has been based around that, so they're all running around like, you know, like Al Capone basically. So they did that kind of thing. There was the Nazi planet as well, which was a bit strange.
Right.
So yeah.
You're right. It's not unprecedented, and if anything, they're kind of tapping back into that. I really appreciate about the series, even on the Next Generation. They weren't afraid to poke fun at themselves, and I think that's such a great thing for watching. You know, they have humility.
And Leonard Nimoy is he directs this one again. Like, so he had directed The Search for Spock, and then I think they were like, all right, well, that was kind of successful. You did a good job there. Let's see what else do you want to do? And I mean, he must have had something in his mind where he wanted to make comedies or something, because not only did he do this, but then the next year, in 87, he did Three Men and a Baby. He's the director of that movie. So
I did not know that, Greg.
Yeah.
I didn't know that blows my mind. Wow.
So, holy, I mean, crap. And like, that was, I think that was like one of the biggest, like, what do you call it, box office hits of that year. Like, that was everywhere, that movie. So,
well, I like some of his decisions on directing on 4. In fact, you know, there's that story of he put them, you know, since they were in San Francisco, he put the characters in character in, like, on the streets, kind of filming them on the streets. You know, there's that famous part where, you know, Chekhov is walking around asking people where the nuclear nuclear missiles are in a Russian accent. And, you know, this is towards the end of the Cold War, but it was still the Cold War. And so they're basically asking real people on the street where the nuclear missiles are. And
Right around the time of like War Games and all those other movies.
That's a conscious decision. And it's a real funny one. It's like almost like a TV bloopers and practical jokes. I mean, it's, but I think more sophisticated than that. But I mean, that's an interesting approach. Let's get these guys out on the street and have them in character walking around in the general public.
Yeah, yeah. The way they brought the characters in, I thought, like, they're still, like, they didn't sort of betray. It sounds, I don't want to sound like sort of pretentious or overly sort of analytical or anything, but like they didn't betray who the characters were. Like, you know, like you said, like that moment with Chekhov being like, wow, the nuclear vessels, you know, all this sort of shit. Like, but like, that's still a very Chekhov thing to do. Like, he was always kind of like, what's wrong? Like, I'm just asking you a question. Like, I don't, why are you upset? Like, he was very much like that. And then of course, like Bones, especially, when they get to the hospital and him just being, you know, him being like the 23rd century doctor, and then they're saying like, oh, what's with you? Oh, I've got kidney dialysis. And then he's like, dialysis? It's, you know, goddamn dark ages and all this kind of stuff.
His reaction is fantastic in there. And I think really relatable in a weird way, you know. I don't know. The movie puts a lot of great things in context.
I just remember when they want to operate on Chekhov, because obviously towards the end of the movie, you know, he falls off the whatever it is, the aircraft carrier or whatever, the ship, and you know, they're going to operate, and they're like, well, we need to relieve the pressure, and he's like, oh, what are you doing? Like, you don't just drill holes in his head. Like, it's just really let Bones be Bones. And in the movies, he could sort of let loose a bit more, because he can sort of be a bit feistier and a bit angrier and, you know, say heck and damn and, you know, this sort of thing. So, whereas on the TV show, you always just had to sort of infer that that's what he meant. So,
well, is this the same movie where they're in a Spock and Bones and Kirk are in a holding cell, and they've got to break out of it, and they discover that Spock's the one that actually beta tested escaping from it?
No, that's Star Trek V. Yeah.
Okay. I saw that. I love that scene. I want to put a foot up his ass, and Bones is want me to hold him, Jim?
Yeah.
Like, it almost seems ad-libbed. Anyway.
But they're a good, like Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, obviously they're this sort of trinity within Star Trek. Oh, yeah. And but they still have some good moments in this together as well, because you, like, Spock has been resurrected, but he's not quite with it. Yeah, exactly. And Kirk's trying to be like, you know, like, you used to call me Jim, and like all this sort of stuff. Like, we're friends, you know, like, you don't have to call me Admiral and this. And yet Bones just comes in and just goes like, what's wrong with him? Like, he's broken.
Yeah,
you know?
they all become, in a weird way, they all become amplified. Spock becomes more Spockish in a way that the other characters don't want him to be.
Yeah.
Bones gets more grumpier, and Kirk gets more narcissistic. What fun. And I mean, it's just fantastic.
Yeah. I like that they sort of gave, and it's probably again because Nimoy was in the director's chair, but I like that this is the movie that kind of sets Spock back onto being himself almost. Because at the start of the movie, you know, he's on Vulcan and they've retrained his brain and all this kind of stuff. So he's sort of like in full Vulcan mode. And I remember at the start of the movie, he's doing the test and it's like, what's this, what's that? And there are all these equations and scientific, you know, tests and stuff that he's doing. And then the last one is like, how do you feel? And he's just stumped by it. He's like, I don't understand. Like, you know, but then because then they go back in time and you get scenes like with Kirk and Spock, where they're on the bus with the punk that's got like the, mm-hmm. the punk music cranking out, and, mm-hmm. and Kirk's like, "Will you turn off that damn noise?" You know, and of course, Spock just hits him with the nerve pinch and stuff. But it leads to like a funny sort of little back and forth with him, because that's when Spock's like, "Oh, I noticed like you've started swearing and stuff now that we're back in this time period and stuff." And Kirk's kind of, uh-huh. "That's just how they talk here. You gotta swear every second word." But then throughout the movie, then Spock is trying to fit in by swearing, right. and just doing it in the worst way, which is great, I thought, you know.
I see roots of Data in some of these kind of interactions. I mean, that's a very Data thing. Of course, Data grew out of Spock, in my opinion. And this is a really good example of that. I can totally see Data at this stage, you know, behaving the same way if he was in the same situation.
Mm. I just love at one point where Gillian, the woman who's like the whale researcher or whatever at the institute, she's like, you know, "Who the hell are you guys? And, you know, how do you know that the whale is pregnant and all this kind of stuff?" And nobody knows that. And Spock's like, "Oh, well, she does, you know, because he's done the mind meld on the whale." And she's like, "Oh, yeah, I suppose she told you, did she?" And he says, "Well, the hell they did." Like, it's just like...
It's really fun. I mean, it's pretty brilliant. I'd like to know more about Nimoy. He seems to have been a pretty funny and pretty complex guy. I think he was actually he's a musician. I play piano. He was a jazz piano player. The more I find out about that guy, the more intriguing that the Spock character kind of becomes to me as well.
He really fits in well, and just by the end of it, of course, as well, realizing that like it sort of took that craziness to kind of like of 1986 San Francisco to kind of make him realize. Yeah. And by the end of it, he's kind of back to like quote unquote normal. Like he is still that stoic Vulcan and stuff, but you know he leans towards Kirk and stuff like that when he needs to. So it's a good sort of background B plot, which is cool.
How do we get his feelings back? Well, we take him, we throw him in San Francisco, I think if you want to get a little deep, you know, that's people need conflict and interaction and situations in order to build character. And that's certainly what happened to him.
I feel that this is probably one of Shatner's best, best outings or best performances as Kirk as well in this movie, even though it's kind of a lighthearted comedy, like, because he, like, even on the show, like, Shatner always shined the best when he got to play Kirk as this kind of jovial, like, fun-loving kind of guy. And like, again, for him to sort of be stuck with these heavy themes in Wrath of Khan, because like that whole, not only like do we have where Spock dies at the end of that movie, which is obviously like hugely traumatic for Kirk, but like that whole movie he's like having a midlife crisis, you know what I mean? He's basically turned 50 and just like, "Oh, what do I do? Like, my life is over and I hate being an admiral and all this kind of stuff." So and then for Search for Spock to kill his son, it's like, there's all this stuff is just heaped on Kirk. So it's good that he's able to sort of be able to lighten up a bit in this movie and stuff. And all of his like aloofness and things like that to money and stuff, like where they're like, "Oh, I'll give you $100. He's like, "Is that a lot?" Like, it's just,
the movie's a good reset for everyone. It gives everybody a break.
Yeah,
really, in a weird way. I forget the female interest in the movie. Does she come back to the future with them?
Yeah, she ends up, Gillian. Yeah, she ends up getting on the ship with them when they're about to leave, and she ends up in the future. And that's a funny scene at the end of that too, because Kirk's kind of doing what Kirk does. It's like, all right, well, we're here now, so all right, like time to get the girl kind of thing. And she's just like, oh, I gotta go. I'm going on like this research ship. Like, I'll see you later. Kirk just sort of looks at her like, oh, all right. It's like, he even says, he goes, oh, I didn't even get your phone number, you know. But it's like, yeah, well, so it's cool though, because they sort of, it showed that they were aware of it. It's like, okay, of course, like she's going to end up with Kirk. And it's like, nah, that's, you know, that's not what happened.
Don't have to be that.
Yeah. Right.
So, I mean, yeah, it, no matter what time, no matter what centuries he's in, we can still do this. We don't have to have her hook up with him. He can. She's got other things to do to focus on.
Yeah. Well, I always thought it was funny. It's like, well, hang on, like, Kirk, she was born, like, from your point of view, she was born, like, 300 years ago. Like, I'm sure she's heard all your pickup lines by now.
Totally. Absolutely.
I do like as well that they had, like you said earlier when we started, there's kind of an environmental message to this as well, about like you know, wiping out the whales and other species and things like that, and ultimately that is something that would like doom the whole planet in the future kind of thing. So the sure. fact that, you know, they've in the Star Trek universe, you know, like the world sort of hunted these humpback whales to extinction, and then it mm-hmm. turns out that the only thing that can save them is the creature that they eradicated. So it's an interesting sort of thing, which again is something Star Trek used to do all the time on the show. They had quite a lot of allegory and stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's, I like the part where, I don't know if it's Chekhov or no, it's Scotty gives somebody the formula for transparent aluminum.
Yeah.
Like, why'd you do that? And he goes, and Scotty's like, well, for all I know, he's the one that invented it.
Yeah,
you know, and
yeah,
that was a good point. No, it's. I think it, you know, the environment's a big deal. It's nice that a movie that big, that far back, started tackling that issue on a big scale.
Yeah, it's cool. It's not like nowadays you think, oh yeah, okay, sure, but like yeah, back then it was, yeah. And I remember as a kid, like there, you know, towards the end of primary school here, it would have been like grade 7, mm-hmm. you know, around sort of 1990 and that kind of time. That's when sort of I remember all the environmental stuff kind of being on TV every 5 minutes, you know, like there's a hole in the ozone layer and all mm-hmm. this sort of stuff. Like it seemed to be sort of huge back then. So, and I mean, in 86, that was before all that. So they were sort of, you know, Nimoy was sort of trying to get the word out, like, before it was cool almost, you know, like it was,
yeah.
Yeah. So
was Roddenberry, was he still alive at this point?
Yeah. I think he died a bit after this. I think it was like 91 or 92. Okay. Cause I remember Next Gen had started, cause he sort of helped, he basically helped create that obviously. So that had sort of well and truly started and been gone for a bit there.
I'll have to hand it to them. They brought Star Trek's really forward thinking on social issues, environmental issues, always has been.
Yeah.
I have to commend them for that. Yeah. Did you watch it in the theater or did you just watch it?
No, I remember seeing it on video.
Yeah.
Mum always used to like Star Trek. And as a kid, I was never really into it at all. And it's weird because I wasn't really like, I wasn't a Star Wars kid either. I was just sort of like, oh yeah, I don't mind Star Wars, but you know, I was all about, you know, Transformers and Ninja Turtles and He-Man and that sort of stuff. Whereas, yeah, but I remember Mum brought it home. She's like, it's the new Star Trek movie. And I was like, why do I want to watch that? You know? Mm-hmm. And she said, no, this is supposed to be a funny one. I was like, okay. So we watched it and I was like, yeah, it was great. So yeah. this movie probably actually kicked off my love of Star Trek, you know, because then it's like, well, what else have they got? You know, and you sort of go and look back. So yeah, but it's definitely a movie that anyone can sort of watch. Like it helps if you've seen the others and you sort of like Wrath of Khan and Search for Spock, but I mean, you don't desperately need to because they give you a little sort of a fill-in recap at the start anyway. So
yeah, No, I for all I know, this was the first one I watched. I don't remember for sure, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah.
And at the time when I watched it, it didn't. I got enough to kind of understand what was going on and enjoy the movie.
Yeah, and I do love the ending too, where it's sort of like, in a weird way, like Kirk is demoted. They're like, all right, Kirk, you're in trouble for doing all those things you did, so you're not admiral anymore, or you've been demoted back to captain. And he's like, oh no. Mm-hmm. He's like, good, I want to be captain, I don't want to be admiral anymore.
Right.
It's funny that he can sort of, he can like face the consequences for his actions, but then in a weird way he kind of still gets everything he wants. Mm-hmm. So, because yeah, he realizes like his place is captain of a ship, and then they get a new Enterprise at the end of the movie too, which so that's cool. We get the Enterprise A, which obviously then sets the stage for next gen, where it's the Enterprise D and going on from there. So yeah. But no, I mean, I really think, like, sort of as we wrap up, because I know you're short on time, but
yeah,
as looking back, I really think like this could have literally been the final Star Trek film if they decided to do that way, as far as Kirk and that goes. Like, it could have. I'm glad that they, well, Star Trek 5, not so much, but I'm glad that they did do 6 with Undiscovered Country. That's a great movie too.
Absolutely.
But if this had been it, if they'd sort of been like, okay, well, we've had our trilogy now, and a movie ends with Kirk back in the captain's chair and a new Enterprise and Spock's back to life, and you know, off they go into the universe to sort of carry on like they do. So that could have really worked. But yeah, like we said, a little hiccup with the next movie, but I still feel they sort of ended strong with Undiscovered Country with number 6. But yeah, but this one in particular, I think it's
totally,
like we said, I think Wrath of Khan is technically a better movie, but this one's my favorite for sure. So
yeah, it's funny how that works out sometimes. You don't always have to like the best one, just like the one you like.
That's right. Well, I still like, even for Star Wars, for instance, like, I know people sort of almost like, oh my God, like, look at me funny when I say this, but like, I really like Return of the Jedi better than the original Star Wars.
You know? Totally agree. Yeah, like, I get some flack for that. I like the interaction on Jedi. I like the things that happen on it. I think I like Jedi, though. It's obvious, it's because of what I already understand about the characters at that point. So that
The heavy lifting's been done already. You can just watch them swing lightsabers and
let's heroic watch things. Yeah. Let's watch a Sarlacc burp. Sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I love it. Yeah. If it would have happened in the first movie, I would have thought it was a little random. But this, it works in Jedi just fine.
Yeah. All right. Well, like we said, this is a quick slingshot around the sun today, kids.
Yes.
Just to you know, get a show out there when the internet in Arizona doesn't work. But anyway, before we go, please follow us on Twitter. The show is at UnfunnyNTangent. I'm at GregT13. You can follow Caleb over at APodDcast, because of the Autopod Decepticast. Let me say that again. Autopod Decepticast podcast that he's a part of with Aaron and Ryan, which is really great. If you haven't heard that and you have any sort of passing interest in Transformers at all, check that out. That's always fun. But of course, all roads lead to at the Steel Cage and thesteelcage.com, and of course unfunnynerdtangent.com, where you can check out more madness from myself and our usual crew of hooligans. But yeah, that'll do us for episode 120. Thanks again, Caleb, for joining me on this emergency broadcast.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it. Thanks for hitting me up. I'm always happy to just have conversations with you. And so looking forward to more of them. I know eventually we're going to get to that Big Trouble in Little China discussion.
Yep.
So Thanks another for inviting me on today.
35 years old, so yeah.
Oh yeah. We got to get to that one soon. So again, not what I would call the best movie, but definitely one of my most favorite. So yeah, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
No worries. Thanks very much. And so like I said, kids, that's it for episode 120. So yeah, that'll do it. And remember, kids, well, double dumbass on you.